Welcome to the Science of Sports Recovery Podcast. I'm your host, Jace Kraft, and today on the show, I am interviewing Sarah Schlichter. She is a registered dietitian with a master's in public health. She co-hosts the sports fueling podcast, Nail Your Nutrition. So you better go check that out after you're done with this podcast, of course. She is passionate about helping athletes fuel adequately and blending the principles of sports nutrition with intuitive eating. And we are going to find out all about what intuitive eating is and what that means for you as the athlete. Sarah also owns and operates the blog and brand Bucket List Tummy, which helps inspire easy recipes and meal ideas that disseminate evidence-based information as well as nutrition for running, which is focused exclusively on nutrition needs for runners. So like I said, we're going to explore what she actually means by intuitive eating. It's a new concept for me. I'm excited to share this for you and how you can stop stressing about food. Let's get into it.
You're listening to the Science of Sports Recovery Podcast. Each week, we explore how to recover more efficiently from training so you can work out harder and realize your full potential. This is the Science of Sports Recovery Podcast.
Sarah, it's great to have you on the show.
Thanks so much for having me, Jace. I'm really excited to have this conversation today.
Awesome. Well, I'm excited too. But before we get into what intuitive eating is and what that means for athletes, I like to just take a little step to find out who's the athlete behind the sports, kind of science individual. Because if you are in the sports field in any capacity, you have that competitive spirit in you. So I'm curious to know, what sport was it for you first? I know at right now you do marathons and that's awesome. But where was your introduction to sport? Maybe 4, 5, 6 years old?
Yeah, I love this question because I haven't really talked publicly about it, I don't think, before. But I actually grew up playing baseball with the boys. I played even my freshman year in high school. I was the only girl on the team. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, my dad just gave me a glove and a bat at a young age, and he played baseball in college, and he was just passionate about it, and I had a great arm, so we kind of just went with it. So I enjoyed T-ball up through Little League, all of that. And then in high school, I added basketball and soccer, so I was just kind of always active as a child. Mm-hmm. And played transition from baseball to softball because I realized, well, I could have a future in this, and you know, girls have fast pitch softball in college. So transitioned to softball and played in college. And after college, I made the switch from team sports to kind of the individual sport. I mean, I guess you could make the argument that running could be a team sport. But I started running as a way to kind of just keep active because all you need is a pair of running shoes and somewhere to go. And my now husband, at the time, he was a college cross country and track and field coach. Mm-hmm. So he was very passionate about it too. So I think he kind of rubbed off on me, and this sport that I really despised in high school, like I never would have thought I would be the one to go for a run for fun. And now it's turned into something that I really love and enjoy.
Yeah, it's funny you say that because I talk to a lot of post-collegiate athletes that will take up running as kind of like their sport of choice afterwards, because it's, like you said, it's easy to do. You have, you know, your shoes and an outfit and you're good to go. That didn't previously run before that. But I also talk to a lot of runners like myself that are like, I don't want to run anymore. And like, you know, that's what they did for, you know, 12, 15 years leading up to that. And now they're like done with it. I love that you said you played baseball with the boys, though, because my sister did that, too. At one time, I have 3 siblings, 2 brothers and a sister, and we were all on the same baseball team at one time. It was kind of funny. She didn't go on to softball, but she stuck with running like we all did. But so I'm curious to know just a little bit, not to go too far down this rabbit hole, But because we have the similarity, like, what was it like playing with the boys as a girl? Was it, like, did you get a lot of, I don't know, teasing or kind of, you know, a stereotype type of mockery with that?
Not to my knowledge. I mean, I think, like, there's some immaturity as, like, growing up with the Little League age, like, oh, there's a girl. But then, like, not to toot my own horn, they realized I was pretty good. Like, I could hold my own. I was a pitcher. I could throw a curveball. Like, I could strike them out. So I think it was just, it turned into just camaraderie. Like, oh, she's one of us. I was shy, though. So I wasn't, like, hanging out with them or, like, outspoken at all. I was pretty shy and quiet, but I just went to play and have fun. And then in high school, I think I probably got more flack from, like, other teams and competitors, but my teammates were pretty, like, I grew up in a small town and we knew of each other. So they knew of me before high school. So at that point, it's just like, oh, yeah, there's Sarah. Like, she's on the team. She comes to practice. I felt pretty respected. I think I was probably more self-critiquing than other people were.
Did that boost your resume for college softball to say, hey, I played baseball with the boys? Or is it like, hey, baseball and softball aren't really the same thing?
Yeah, so I think the college coach, UMass, is who recruited me. She kind of realized, like, oh, yeah, she didn't grow up playing softball. So she's like, she's got the raw potential, but she has to be molded into a softball player type thing. Sure. So I think they kind of saw the base I had and the potential. And I played softball in high school as I made the switch, but I still think I had things to learn and a ways to go. But, you know, the fundamentals were the same.
For sure. What was your college career like then in softball? Did you have a lot of success, or was it something that you just did? Or talk to us a little bit about that.
Yeah, I wasn't expecting to talk about all of this today, but I mean, I have a lot of thoughts and a lot of just, I don't think I was prepared to play Division I where I ended up. I think had I done more research, I think I would have been a better fit for Division II or III. I wasn't ready for softball to take over my life in the way it did, as it does in a Division I college sports setting. I liked it. I didn't love it. And freshman year still was very exciting, though. I mean, you have teammates who turn into be your best friends right away. Mm-hmm. So that was really nice. And the traveling part was exciting. But I was in my head. I think I could have benefited from, like, a sports psychologist, because I would just, like, really stress out about things. Or if I did something at practice, or I was trying to perfect a bunt, or how I handle a bunt, or anything like that, I would just, like, really stress about it. So I didn't end up playing all 4 years. I kind of realized, like, taking a step back was right for me. But freshman year, we did make it to, like, the NCAAs, and traveling to Austin, Texas, facing an Olympic pitcher who went on to be an Olympic pitcher, Kat Osterman. Nice. So that was, like, a really, really cool experience. So, I mean, as with anything, she threw a no-hitter against us, but I hit a line drive to the shortstop. So I hit it, but not to an open area.
Gotcha.
but it was still exciting. Yeah. Like, I didn't strike out, so.
Yeah. That's cool.
I mean, I have so much respect for college athletes, and now, like, being on the other side and working with them, it's like I can relate to what they're going through and the pressures of everything in terms of sport and what you're eating and what your body looks like and managing education alongside. And it's definitely a lot. So, yeah, looking back, I think Division III, a little bit less hardcore, would have been fun for me. But, you know, you don't know what you don't know.
Yeah, for sure. And I totally get that. And I like that you say you can relate, because that's why I ask these questions at the beginning of most of my interviews, is because I want to let the listeners know that the people that I bring on, like, relate as athletes and then as, you know, academics second, because I think I get a little skeptical when researchers or coaches never have that experience of actually playing, because there's so much more to it than just, you know, training and performing. There's so much mental side to it. There's so much, you know, outside pressures and that kind of stuff that affect performance, affect how your nutrition, you know, even gets absorbed in your body, you know, because if you're stressing out, you know, 90% of the day and you're still eating, like, it's going to be way different than if you're relaxed and eating the same thing, you know, it's going to absorb differently. So I like to get to know, like, hey, you know what it's like. So my question is then, when did sports nutrition become like key to you? Like, when did you say, hey, this is the field I want to go into?
Yes. Yeah, so I did, obviously grew up loving sports and I always thought I wanted to work in sports. However, I didn't really know about nutrition. Like, honestly, growing up, I grew up privileged with food security, you know, having access to food, always having food available, which I don't take for granted. And my parents were very just like, let's eat as a family. So I think they instilled a really great relationship with food for me at a young age. But again, in college, I wasn't thinking twice about what I was eating. Actually, everyone on the softball team called me snacks because I was constantly eating. I would bring like a box of cereal to class and they're like, you're eating again? So I guess I've always had kind of like an interest or just fascination with food and what works for me. But I graduated with a business degree. It was actually sport management. So I originally thought I wanted to work on the business side of sports, whether it be like in marketing or sports information. I did that a little bit after college. So it's kind of writing the articles that you'll see on the website. You played college sports or you ran in college. You probably know about like the meet results and who would write about that. So I did that for a little bit and I kind of bounced around figuring out what I didn't want to do. And somewhere around 2010, 2012, I realized like I had this passion for nutrition and food. And I did research. I was like, well, why don't I just take a prereq class just to make sure I like it before I decide to go back to school. I took the class and I loved it. And then I kind of realized I can blend an interest in nutrition with my love for athletics. It doesn't have to be one or the other. And as a former college athlete and thinking about how I really had no knowledge about what pre and post workout nutrition looked like. It was just kind of all the same to me, but really taking an interest in how I could help other athletes fuel appropriately or just try to simplify things because there's just so much information coming at us from all different angles that it can be a little bit overwhelming.
Yeah. Now, my next question is going to be probably hard to answer because you've been in the nutrition world so long, but I'm curious to know, like, when you were in college, do you think that there's more people now that kind of have a fundamental understanding of proper nutrition compared to back then? Like, are we progressing as a society knowing, like, what proper nutrition is? Or is it just so much information now that it's just hard to believe, like, you know, anything you hear?
Yes, an interesting question. I'm going to answer it this way, that I think there's more awareness now in the importance of nutrition for college athletes. And there's still a lot of schools that don't have a dedicated sports dietitian. So we didn't have one back when I was in school at UMass. We had a strength and conditioning specialist who would help us in the weight room, but we didn't have anyone saying, well, make this protein shake or, you know, eat this many carbs for your game, or we would play double headers for softball. You should have this between. We didn't have any of that. Whereas now I think it's becoming more commonplace for teams to have a sports dietitian. I mean, most pro teams, I don't think all, but most have a sports dietitian, and college athletic departments are moving towards that way now, which is great. I still think there's a lot of room to grow, especially in terms of the issues and challenges that athletes face, specifically college athletes, if you want to stick with that population, just in terms of travel or not eating enough, relative energy deficiency. That's a really big thing that's going around in my groups. And I don't know if it's because these are the populations I'm talking to or I'm dealing with or just the other dietitians that are in my circle, but I'm hearing a lot of talk about that stuff these days.
Yeah. Did you said relative energy deficiency?
Yeah, red S, it's relative energy deficiency in sport.
Cool. We've talked a little bit about this in actually multiple interviews. Our last one with Kylie Old-Miller, a lacrosse player, she mentioned that, that like she started eating more when she started paying attention to her nutrition, and she actually got leaner. I think REDS, was something that I definitely struggled with in college, that led to a lot of different things, but, ultimately poor performance. So can you expand on that a little bit? Like, what do you actually mean by that? How do you know if, you know, you experienced that?
Definitely. And, I will say, so a lot of people know this as the female athlete triad. That's kind of what we used to call it as, meaning like poor bone health in females, maybe menstrual irregularities and just not eating enough to begin with. But then we started to realize like it affects more than just those things. It affects cognitive function. It affects hormones. It affects sleep, immunity, obviously injury risk, and so much more psychological things. So we realized it affects males too. Males can suffer from an energy deficiency. So now it's the International Olympic Committee designated it as our red S, relative energy deficiency in sport. And it doesn't always have to be an athlete or even an elite athlete. I mean, the everyday athlete or runner could be experiencing this too. But essentially, it's a mismatch for your energy intake and your energy expenditure. So if you take all of the calories or food you eat during the day and subtract the exercise you're doing and subtract the energy burned from activities of daily living, so just breathing, your heart pumping, you know, like walking up and down the stairs, if that number is in the negative balance, you're in an energy deficit. And you may not see effects in the short term. And it's a little bit different for males and females. Females will probably see some side effects sooner. But in the long term, you will see some side effects, whether it's like bone fractures or more stress fractures, injuries, irregular periods or lack of period. We call that amenorrhea. Really obsessing about food or not being able to focus or concentrate, depression, anxiety. You think about Mary Kane came out and talked about the depression that she was experiencing just because she was in such an energy depleted state. Mm-hmm. So it really affects the cardiovascular system, the endocrine system, respiratory system. It affects pretty much all of our systems. Just being in an energy deficit. And obviously, like you mentioned, that's all going to contribute to poor performance, poor recovery, your relationship with sport, overtraining, yeah, poor sleep, totally. Things like that.
Yeah. And that, like, I think we talk about this a lot now. And I like that you've given it kind of a name because we haven't really named it on the show yet. So Sarah is officially naming it, although she's, you know, didn't come up with it. But anyways, so I like that. But what about, like, I mean, I eat until I'm full, right? And then I go to bed and, you know, I'm doing all this activity. Isn't that enough? Or is that always enough? Like, how do I know that I've eaten enough besides, you know, trying to track everything that I ate caloric wise, as well as everything I did, you know, energy output wise? Like, how do you know?
Yeah, it's a great question. I think part of this is learning to be in tune with your body. So this kind of like underlying message when we're talking about intuitive eating or just kind of being in touch with your body's needs. You know, we talk about eating when you're hungry, stopping when you're full. It's obviously a lot more complex than that. But I would say, you know, you're eating enough if you're not experiencing those side effects. So a lot of the symptoms that we mentioned. So maybe your performance is not suffering. Your injury risk is good. You're not suffering from chronic injury. You're able to focus on sport. You're able to focus on other parts of your life. You're not thinking about food all the time. Mm-hmm. Your hormones are balanced, meaning that you're able to sleep at night. Your cortisol is not through the roof. And looking at meals, you're eating regular meals too. I really think it's difficult for athletes to get enough food if they're not incorporating snacks between meals, especially if they're training intensely. It's just really hard to meet energy needs through just those meals and pre-post-workout snack. Once we talk about longer exercises, eating during that as well. So I think it's going to vary person to person, but just being aware of any side effects you may or may not be experiencing can be a good place to start.
If you stick around and listen to enough of our episodes here on the Science of Sports Recovery podcast, you'll notice a common theme of importance of mobility in recovery and injury prevention. That's why I recommend checking out the Ready States Virtual Mobility Coach to help you improve your mobility, recoverability, and injury prevention. The Ready State is a brainchild of coach and athlete Dr. Kelly Starrett, who you can learn more about on episode 13. His Virtual Mobility Coach program helps athletes understand the importance of recovery, pain relief, and self-care. In other words, it helps fix the recovery side of training so you can keep seeing results from your workouts. His program will guide you through the same mobilizations used on athletes in the NFL, NHL, and MLB, provide custom tools for pain relief, give you customized pre and post exercise mobilizations based on your training and sports schedule, and deliver daily mobilizations to keep you on track to achieve your goals. You put your heart and soul into your workouts. Make sure you get the most of them by going to thereadystate.com/Jace. Again, that's thereadystate.com/JASE. The link will also be in the show notes. Now, back to the show.
How similar are these side effects, if you know, to like lack of sleep? Because what you're saying, also I find those side effects when, you know, I go a couple nights with 4 or 5 hours of sleep. I'm like, I can't focus. I got headaches. You know, what are the similarities, if you know at all, or what are the differences with those two, if you know?
Yeah, so in terms of what you're experiencing, like you go a couple nights without like good, solid, consecutive sleep. Maybe you just crave sugary foods. And there's a reason for that. Our hunger hormone is elevated when we're stressed out or we don't get enough sleep like that. So we might think we're hungrier when in reality our hormone ghrelin is just rising, because even 1 to 2 nights of poor sleep can lead to this rise in the hormone. So you might feel, you might feel just like you want sugar all day, and you can trace that back to, you know, not getting a few good night's sleeps. Mm-hmm. I think the main difference is just, it's going to be more of a chronic thing. So, if you are always thinking about your next meal, so you eat something and you're just not satisfied, or you can't wait to eat, you know, the cookies later in the day, maybe you're under eating during the day and overcompensating at night. Or your body is just focusing on sugar foods all the time rather than protein or vegetables because it's telling you it needs quick energy, and that's what quick energy is. Or, you know, you're just stressing and you don't have enough mental space to think about other things. That's one way to tell. And not eating enough can disrupt your sleep too. That's where, you know, things can get a little murky, because our body is in a stress state, essentially. Our cortisol is rising if we're underfueled, and the body isn't able to complete, you know, its functional things as it would if you were getting enough food. So overtraining and or undereating can lead to sleep disruption.
Is it possible to overeat?
I think it might be a subjective thing. So I have clients come to me saying like, okay, I overate, or I'm, you know, I'm eating a lot at night and then I feel really guilty about it. And there is a criteria for binge eating. That's a diagnostic. It's a DSM-5 recognized diagnosis that you can have under an eating disorder. But overeating is, I feel like that's normal. I don't want to make these sound like they're, you know, it's not a big deal at all. Like, overeating is a part of, in my mind, a normal relationship with food. Sometimes you undereat, sometimes you overeat, and it's normal to feel a little bit extra full, and then maybe you're not as hungry for your next meal. But if you're at a point where maybe you're chronically eating really quickly, or you're just sneak eating, closet eating, or you're feeling very shameful and guilty after eating, that's when it would kind of cross over into maybe a diagnostic term or disordered eating tendency.
Sure. Cool. Well, let's get into like exactly what intuitive eating is. I know we've kind of touched a little parts of it here and there so far, but if you could just give us like a one sentence or two sentence definition of intuitive eating, we'll start with that and we'll get into it a little bit more.
Sure. So I'll give the definition from the founders. So actually two dietitians, their names are Elise Resch and Evelyn Triboli. They founded intuitive eating in 1995, and they kind of coined it as a self-care eating framework. And it really blends instinct, emotion, and rational thought. So when I'm telling people that, because that's kind of like a mouthful, I just tell people it's really getting back to the way that we were innately born to eat. Like it's quote unquote normal eating. When we start to follow all of these diets and guidelines, we really get away from the foods our body actually likes and wants, and what hunger feels like and what fullness feels like. So it's really just learning to get back in tune with those innate signals.
Okay. So what's the first step? Like, how do you say I'm like, I always crave ice cream, you know, per se. I know that's probably not something that I should be craving all the time. It's not something that, you know, that I should have for breakfast, dinner, and supper or whatever. Like, how do I know what's the difference between that craving and what you're talking about with intuitive eating?
Yeah, so if we were to look at this from an intuitive eating lens, so first I want to say there's a lot of misinformation about intuitive eating. So people think it's, you know, eat whatever you want when you want it. And that might be part of intuitive eating, but that's really a privileged way to look at it. Because if I'm making dinner and say I really want a cheeseburger, but I don't have that at home, it's not really practical for me to think I'm going to drive to get a cheeseburger just to satisfy that craving, when in reality I can just make something, make do at home. So it's not always that simple, and it's also not eat when you're hungry, stop when you're full. Because if we only look at it that way, we're applying rules and rigidity, and anything with rules is really similar to a diet. So the idea of intuitive eating is to get away from the diet, the rules, rigidity. So for your example, looking at it as ice cream, intuitive eating blends emotion, instinct, and rational thought. So if you were to wake up saying like, oh, I like ice cream, I really want it for breakfast, maybe your rational thought would say, well, Jace, you know, last time you had ice cream for breakfast, like you didn't feel very good and you were hungry an hour later, and you know, you have a big workout coming up, you have a big meeting today, why don't you choose something that's going to sustain you longer? So it's not depriving yourself of the ice cream, but it's taking rational thought into consideration too. And maybe it's saying, well, why don't you have the ice cream after your workout or later in the day? Because that's when you can actually sit down and enjoy it. And if you feel a little bloated after, it's okay, because you don't have to go perform.
So what I'm hearing you say, it's not just following your cravings wherever they may lead, but more so understanding what your body is telling you that you want, and then also understanding like the history of how that affects your body and what you're trying to accomplish for, you know, that day and on. Is that kind of what I'm hearing?
Yeah, I think that's a great way to look at it. And we've actually skipped, you know, there's 10 principles, and the one we're talking about now is the last principle of gentle nutrition, really taking that self-care into consideration. But this is the principle, honestly, that I find comes up mostly with athletes, because we have this sports nutrition knowledge, right? Like there's no reason to not do what we know is going to enhance sports performance. You know, we want to eat carbohydrates before a workout. We want to eat carbohydrates and protein, leucine rich protein after a workout. We want to hydrate enough. So we have those principles. That's the knowledge piece. The intuitive eating piece is just basically choosing foods that you like within those food groups. So I wouldn't want to go tell someone to eat, let's say, whole wheat pasta before a race if they hate whole wheat pasta. I would say, well, what carbs do you like? Oh, you like bagels? Great. That's a carb-rich food. That's what your body needs before a race. So let's incorporate that before, because the whole point with intuitive eating is we want you to enjoy your foods and we want you to pick foods that you enjoy, but that also make you feel good.
Gotcha. So you mentioned there's 10 principles. Could you talk about some of the other ones that would maybe mostly apply to athletes?
Definitely. So I will, and you can add this to the show notes. It's just intuitiveeating.org. That's the website that kind of houses all of the information about each principle. There's a lot of resources on there. There's over 100 published studies about intuitive eating. So this isn't a novel concept. And there's actually a lot of research backing it. So for people who want to learn more, I would recommend going there. The principles, when I'm talking with athletes about how sports nutrition and intuitive eating overlap, the ones I usually start with are honor your hunger. And that's, again, what most people think of when they hear intuitive eating. Now, with athletes, we have higher needs, generally speaking, than the regular population. We are exerting ourselves. Our muscles need more fuel and replenishment. And if we don't do that, we're eventually going to suffer some side effects or our performance is just not going to improve. So honoring your hunger, when I'm working with people, we really want to get back in touch with what does hunger even feel like? So much of us have just, so many times we just think of a growling stomach for hunger, mm-hmm. but it could be a lack in concentration or a headache or just feeling like you need to take a nap, just feeling so energetically drained, only thinking about food. All of those are signals of hunger too. So it's really learning what hunger looks like for you and not allowing yourself to go too long without eating. So that's a big one.
How do you distinguish hunger from thirstiness?
It's a good question. I think this is going to be individual, but especially in the beginning stages, it can be helpful to kind of not necessarily track and write down what you're eating, but just like mentally say, okay, when's the last time I ate? If it's been 2 or 3 hours, it's probably hunger. Otherwise, you know, if it was an hour ago and you're hungry again, there could be a chance you're hungry again, but I would want to kind of dig down and see, well, what are you eating? Maybe we need to switch up the macronutrient composition of your meal or snack to keep you fuller for longer. And otherwise it could be hydration or, you know, if there's cramping, electrolyte balance, depending on, are you at altitude? What's the weather? Is it humid? What did you do for a workout today? Kind of all of that plays into.
Sure. Okay, so honor your hunger, what's another principle?
Yes, and before I go on, I like to give this caveat with athletes. Again, we don't want to turn this into the hunger fullness diet because sometimes you will need to eat when you're not hungry. And the best example of this is after a workout, you know, or a long run, right? I'm sure many of us can attest to you just have no appetite after you've run like 15 miles and it doesn't make sense, but if you know the physiologic, if you know the biology, biochemistry behind it, it makes sense because we have these stress hormones that are high and adrenaline's pumping and our hunger is just blunted. So in those instances, it's important to eat or have a little something, a snack, a smoothie, something. So again, I'm trying to shift people from this all or nothing thinking to it's okay to eat if you're not hungry. And here's a great example why.
Totally. On the interview with Jen Giles, we actually did talk about activity being a appetite suppressant. And we went into kind of that and same thing that we were talking about here. I would go on, you know, 18-mile long runs and then not be hungry the rest of the day. And it's like I just burned, you know, X thousands of calories and I should be stuffing my face, but I just don't feel like it. But so good point there. What are some of the other principles of intuitive eating?
Sure. So the first principle is reject the diet mentality. And this one you know, all of these principles are applicable to everyone. I should have started off by saying, you know, intuitive eating is for anyone and everyone. It's something that we all have the power to do. And this diet mentality really refers to this cultural norm that we all live in that we really feel like we need a set structure, or we have to be following rules, or we've been following diets so long that we don't even know what foods we like or how much to eat. We don't trust ourselves. So rejecting the diet mentality really means like becoming aware of any influences, negative influences, or influences that have skewed a relationship with food. And a lot of this is, it takes time. I mean, if people unknowingly have contributed, whether they grew up around their parents who have been dieting their whole life, or they had a coach in high school who said, if you want to run, you know, a sub, whatever mile, 5K, you need to lose X amount of pounds. And we just learn to internalize a lot of these messages and attribute our worth to our performance, or I'm sorry, our size to our worth, or our size to our performance. So a lot of it is recognizing just the influences, and in that the food you eat doesn't make you a good or bad person. And you are able to kind of get back in touch and figure out, you know, the foods that are stressing you out or that you've heard are quote unquote bad foods. Mm-hmm. Where did you hear that from? And, you know, how can we repair a relationship with that food?
Sure. Sure. You mentioned on your website, actually, I'm just going to quote it right from there. It says, sometimes I think the way we stress about food choices and fear certain foods can actually be more detrimental to our health than the actual food choices themselves. And I think that kind of correlates with what you're saying right now. Can you just expand on that? Like, how does thinking about a food or stressing about a food after you've eaten it impact, you know, what you absorb and what you don't from that food?
Sure. So I think a lot of this is kind of, to me, a lot of the things we mentioned are kind of all coming together with this question. So the reason I take the view on nutrition I do is because I work primarily one-on-one with runners, and we have an all-or-nothing mindset. A lot of athletes do, very perfectionistic, type A. Mm-hmm. And it's really easy to start doing everything possible to try to be better, but in reality, it may be harming us more. So in an effort to quote-unquote eat clean or lose X amount of pounds, maybe we start to cut out one food group and then it leads to another. And pretty soon, our diet becomes bare bone and our performance suffers. But we're not eating the foods that we even like. Maybe we're thinking about the foods that we like, but the idea of eating it has become so stressful and it's so quote unquote normal to avoid it. So this idea that if food is stressing you out, like that's not a normal thing. We do have a stress response that is going on in our body. So every time we, you know, label a food as bad or we have something that we don't want to have, we're really, rather than building that trust with our body, we're breaking it because we're telling our body, you want this food, but you can't be trusted with it. You're going to overeat it and it's going to make you gain X amount of pounds overnight. So this cortisol rise is happening and the neural pathways in our brain are forming. So we talk about this process in intuitive eating known as habituation. And essentially it means the more times you do something, the easier it becomes. So think about like the first time you met your partner, maybe there was butterflies and it was really exciting. And then, you know, yeah. 5 years later, maybe the butterflies aren't there. Not to say you don't love them as much, but you just become yeah. habitualized to it. So it's really the same thing with food. Like the more you're exposed to it, it becomes less exciting. And another thing I like to bring up is this brain-gut connection, right? So we have something called the vagus nerve that connects our brain and gut. And if we're stressing about something in our head, we can feel the side effects in our gut. So maybe that manifests as nerves or anxiety. Maybe it manifests as GI discomfort or not being able to digest a food. And it's not a functional disability. It's something that we're stressing about in our head that's leading to this outcome. And then the last thing I like to say is it takes away from your quality of life. You know, if you really like pizza and your best friends are going out for happy hour with pizza and you're like, oh, sorry, I can't do that. It's after 8 o'clock. I don't eat after 8 o'clock. Or, you know, I'm on a low carb diet this week. Mm-hmm. I mean, is it really worth it? Like, what are your values? And is it important enough for you to impact the quality of life like that?
Sure. Yeah, you got to know at that point, it's more of like a question of value. You know, like, do you, and I'm not saying this like there's one right answer, because there's a lot of really like world-class athletes that have had to make a lot of these decisions of, do you go with the social route or do you go with the route that you know, physiologically will make you a better athlete? And I think that's just individualized. Like you're saying, if you're the person where, hey, I don't want to sacrifice my, you know, relationships with people, then it's okay. Like, it's not going to make or break your career. But if you're the person that's like, I want to literally be the best in the world and do anything I can to do that, then, you know, you have to be then okay with the sacrifices you make on the social front, in my opinion there. You mentioned the brain-gut connection. I'm curious, first, before I ask the follow-up question, have you heard of Dr. Caroline Leaf?
I haven't.
Well, you should look her up. She talks about the neuroscience behind like what you eat and how it affects. And she talks about the brain gut connection and stuff. I'll give you a book recommendation after, the show. Actually, for anybody listening, if you're interested, it's Think and Eat Yourself Smart, by Dr. Caroline Leaf. So anyways, but the brain gut connection, I wanted to know with how that's different between like just eating before a workout versus eating before a big race. Because when you're eating before a big race or competition, there's so much more going on with your body as far as nerves and, you know, outside pressures and that kind of stuff, compared to just a regular workout. So what would you suggest on that front, whereas like you're eating before a big competition and you're really nervous?
Yeah, that's a great question in terms of, I don't think nutrition wise, it would be a different recommendation. So ideally you've practiced, right? We mm-hmm. say never try anything new on race day, but your pre-race meal, you've practiced, you've had it before, whether you're traveling at a new race destination or you're in your hometown making dinner in your house, ideally it's something that you've had. And to decrease any risk of, let's say, GI intolerance or gut discomfort, the sports nutrition recommendations would be, you know, make it blander if you need to, avoid cruciferous vegetables, avoid anything high fiber, high fat. Those can tend to cause a little bit more issues in some people. Do white pasta, white rice over brown rice, whole wheat pasta, things like that. So the nutrition recommendations would be the same, and also stay hydrated. If you're in a dehydrated state, that can aggravate any sensitive stomach issues. In terms of the nerves, I think this would be a great plug for stress management mechanisms, whether it's meditation or visualization. I know that's a big one with sports psychologists and just kind of visualizing. I think with excitement there, you know, we're kind of known for not sleeping well the night before a race just because we are nervous and excited. So maybe two nights before, just doing everything you can to set the stage for success, getting a good night's sleep, eating a balanced dinner, staying hydrated, and again, practicing the meal you'll eat and avoiding any irritant for things that maybe don't sit well with you. So this is where the sports nutrition, the mind piece comes into it, intuitive eating, because, you know, if it's the night before a race and say you really want like a brownie or something for dessert, maybe you're like, oh, that really, really sounds good, but maybe I save that for after my race. You know, I've done all of this preparation. This race is very important to me. And I know nutritionally speaking, this may not sit well. It's a little bit heavy. I may not perform well. So now wouldn't be the best time to have it. So that's where kind of like that rational thinking would come into.
Totally. I hear you loud and clear there, and I'm like a prime example of habitual prior to or meals prior to competition. I think my whole college career, I don't think I went into one race without having a peanut butter and jelly sandwich 3 to 4 hours before the race. That was my thing. And I very rarely then went into the race with GI issues and that kind of stuff. Not that it never happened, because it did, but very rarely. So we're getting close to the end of our time here. So I want to give you kind of a little platform to tell people, you know, what it is exactly that you do, how you can help them. If somebody wants to learn more from you, Sarah, how can they find you and where should they connect with you?
Absolutely. Well, thanks again for having me. So I work primarily with runners and endurance athletes, so cyclists, ultra runners, marathon runners, half marathons, things like that, even, you know, 5K, 10K, and people who really want to understand how to fuel for their sport. So if you're looking to improve performance, if you just can't figure out why you keep hitting the wall, or if you want to improve your relationship with food, maybe feel like you know, are the furthest thing from intuitive and you want to learn more about what that means or how that could look for you, that is, that's my niche. That's who I primarily work with. On our podcast that you mentioned, Nail Your Nutrition, we interview experts in the sports nutrition field, sometimes dietitians, sometimes researchers, sometimes just the everyday athlete, really asking how they fuel, what works for them, what are the guidelines and how it relates to triathlons and marathons and things like that. So that's what we talk about on that podcast. We also have a course that goes along with it, just that really breaks down ultra endurance nutrition needs, because it's a field that it can be a little bit intimidating if you're thinking about going out and not knowing where to start. And then I also just work with people, you know, trying to take the stress away from food, kind of like we talked about today, with making recipes that are easy but fun and just making food enjoyable again. I really value that in my life. So I want to spread the love to other people with that too.
Awesome. Do you have like a recipe PDF or something on your website?
I do. Yeah, I have. There's a few like snack recipes that are great for athletes and easy dinner recipes, like 30 minutes or less, that they can grab there.
Awesome. And is that on bucketlisttummy.com?
Yes. Bucketlisttummy.com.
Awesome. Mm-hmm. Cool. So if you want to connect with Sarah, her website, bucketlisttummy, that's TUMMY.com. Her podcast, Nail Your Nutrition, and she's on Instagram at bucketlisttummy_RD. Sarah, thanks so much for being on the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
All right, episode's over. If you found value in this episode, please consider giving us a review on iTunes. And if you haven't already yet subscribed, do so now so you don't miss any important topics in the coming week. And if you have any questions or suggestions for the show, please send them my way. I am most responsive on Instagram. That's at jcheese, J-A-E, cheese, like the food, or email me directly at jase, J-A-S-E, at scienceofsportsrecovery.com. Talk soon.